Martha, thank you very much for hosting yet again. Another year of this. And thank you everyone who voted on the topic, and I hope the topic will be good, and if not, we can always switch at some point, and that's fine. But we ended up with a topic that I'm sort of thinking of as just giants of. That's just the way of looking at it, because some of you wanted to talk about some of the figures from Halacha, some of you wanted to talk about Parshanut and people who comment on Tanakh. And so what we're basically going to do, it looks like, is go through historically from after the Gemara, working our way forward, and talk about some of the key figures of each time, focusing less on like granular history. I'm not going to do like biography in depth. It's not going to be like serious academic history, but more just to give a sense of who they are, the environment they lived in, who they, you know, what their lives were like, and some of their Torah, so that we can actually learn, you know, what they said. And that's the basic idea. And I hope that that will, I hope that that will fit.
Everyone just shake.
There we go. I hope that'll fit with what everybody had in mind. And then, perfect timing, Nechama, we're going to do Parsha for some period of time also. So we'll have that, we'll have the history part, and we'll have the Halacha part, and we'll have the Parsha part, and all of it together. The only problem, and to those who were here when I walked in, is that I actually left my notes at Or Chaim. I made a mistake. I picked up the Parsha notes and notes for a different shiur that I'm working on, and I completely forgot the notes for this. So I'm working from the source sheet. I think I basically remember what I wanted to say. I will probably come back next time with, oh, I forgot to say X, and that's okay. But hopefully it'll still be somewhat worthwhile. Okay, we ready?
Yeah.
Okay. I hope everybody had a good summer, by the way. Yes? Okay. Anyone who didn't want to share? Okay. So I wanted to just introduce the period of the Gaonim, because we're going to spend time talking about the Gaonim. The Gaonim are the foundation of so much of what we have today, and yet I'd say most people don't really know them. I mean, can you name a Gaon? I'm going to take the Vilna Gaon off the table. He's not one of the Gaonim. Rasadja Gaon, Rav Hai Gaon. Anybody who knows a lot about the Geniza can't speak. Rasadja Gaon, Rav Hai Gaon, who else? Those are two Gaonim. They are legitimate Gaonim. And we're going to talk about both of them, I hope.
I presume the rest of them don't end with the name Gaon.
They all end with Gaon. We're going to call them all Gaon. He's right after the Gaonim. He's right after, very early we shown him. Sorry? No, they're the, not a Gaon.
Hi there.
Hello. The Gaonim will include Rav Shri Ragon, who we're actually going to quote today, God willing. He's on the back of your sheet. So we'll be talking about him. I want to talk about Rav Amram Gaon. He's very important. Rav Natronoi Gaon, I'm not sure we'll get to. Rav Achoy Gaon is very important. These are some really like foundational figures. Just to give an illustration of what I mean by a foundational figure, Rav Amram Gaon wrote the first Siddur. The first Siddur that we have was when a community wrote to him and said to him, can you give us like what we're supposed to be davening, please? And he sent them what is the first, literally the first Siddur.
Before or after Anshin Kassim?
Oh, he's long after. Anshin Kassim Hagadol, the beginning of the second Beis Hamikdash. Right, so we're going to talk about all of this. We're going to orient you historically and all that. Well, we're going to deal with all of that. Another example is Rav Shri Ragon. Rav Shri Ragon wrote the Jewish history work, which answers all the questions that you have that they didn't answer for you in school about how we ended up with Torah. Meaning, he's the one who answers the question of, I don't understand, they're all just passing things down generation to generation, how did we end up with all of these machlokos? Like, why don't we know anything? Why is everything subject to debate if they're just passing it down, teacher to student? He wrote the book, literally. He gave us a historical record of every generation, who the Nasi was, who the Abetin, and going back to the times of the Gemara and running all the way through until his day, which was the I believe 10th century. Yeah, he's 10th century. So he can tell you what year, like, Rava and Abaye passed away. All this stuff is all Rav Shri Ragon writing it out in a letter called Igeres Rav Shri Ragon, which, as you'll see, we have some up on the back of the sheet. So the Gaonim are foundational, and I want to spend some time learning about them before we then go forward, you know, from their time. Clear? Okay.
What are the years?
So that's where, that's where we're going. The Mishnah is concluded by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi in the middle of the early to middle third century Common Era. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is based in Sipori, which is near the Kinneret, in Israel. At that point, you already have Jewish communities in many other places, but that is the anchor. Even though you had very strong Jewish communities, even yeshivos in Babel, the center is in Israel. After that time, it really starts to spread out. And in the period of the Gemara, you find, first of all, Shalmi, which is concluded in Israel, not in Yerushalayim, but we call it Talmud Yerushalmi, because really the alternative is calling it Palestinian Talmud, and no one wants to do that. So we just call it Talmud Yerushalmi as though it was done in Yerushalayim, but it wasn't. The Talmud Yerushalmi is concluded first, and then, a couple of generations later, the Talmud Bavli in Bavel. That one actually is in the area we call Bavel. That is concluded in the middle of the 6th century Common Era. Now, at that point, there are other Jewish communities which we're going to talk about and which are going to matter for the discussion of the Gaonim, but I just wanted to bring you something to illustrate what I'm saying about the scattering of Jews already in this at this point. Jews left Israel, number one, because Chorban, right? Beis HaMikdash is destroyed and we get scattered. Jews also left because of trade. They went commercially to different places and they engaged in business. If you take a look at the first source here, this is from the Wisden edition translation of Josephus's Wars of the Jews. He's quoting King Agrippus. So Agrippus was the king when the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. And here he's warning the Jews living in Israel, don't rebel against the Romans. It's an incredibly bad idea. And what he wants, I mean, he himself is a puppet of the Romans, don't kid yourself. But he says, like, all these other nations fought against the Romans and got destroyed. Why do you think you're going to be any different? Yeah, that kind of an approach. And he says, you should know, you fight against the Romans in Israel, it's going to be bad for Jews throughout the Roman Empire. And take a look at what he says here in number one. He says, the danger concerns not those Jews that dwell here only, but those of them which dwell in other cities also. For there is no people upon the habitable earth which have not some portion of you among them, whom your enemies will slay in case you go to war, and so on. But that's the key note. Jews at that point are already everywhere. It's not like, you know, we were just this little small nation living in Israel with, you know, a few colonies out in Babel. We're everywhere. And again, this is first century Common Era. Clear? Right? The Beis HaMikdash is destroyed somewhere around the year 68, the year 70 of the Common Era. So Jews are already spread out.
What
do you mean?
We are now
5782, right? We're now 5782. So you're basically 3700. Right. So well, that's its own discussion. But the second Beis HaMikdash is destroyed somewhere around the year 3708 or 3710.
Which is 7.
Yes, correct. I was just thrown off guard because people always ask the question the other way. You give them a Hebrew date and they're like, well, what is that in the... Like, so we're going to see a third calendar eventually, but right now we can settle for those two. So throughout the period of the development of the Mishnah, the development of the Gemara, Jewish communities are continuing to grow in areas outside of Israel and in particular in Babel. So the map I gave you in source number two, don't get caught up in all the arrows. They have nothing to do with what we're talking about. I just wanted a map that showed the region in the 7th century, and that's what I got.
So you're jumping 600 years.
I am now jumping through the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara to the period we're going to be talking about, which is the beginning of the period of the Gaonim. The Gaonic period is basically 7th century until the end of the 10th, early 11th. The last Gaon it passes away in the early 11th.
That's right. Rashi started.
That's where, right. So Rashi is already 11th century, and he is in those first generations. We'll talk about them. That's Rabbeinu Gershom or Hagolah. It may be said as the beginning of the Rishonim. He's two generations before Rashi. Yeah, and there's overlap. We'll talk about sort of why one era ends and another era begins.
So 7 to 10,
why does it stop being there?
300 years, give or take 350.
So it's basically call it 400 years and you're safe.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Tanaim and Amoraim come before the Gaonim.
Yes, Tanaim are the Chachamim who teach in the Mishnah. Amoraim are those who teach in the Gemara.
Okay.
Tana literally is one who teaches. Amora is one who speaks. Same
after
idea.
Knowledge?
Yeah, correct.
So, and what do you call the period after the Gaonim?
So that becomes the Rishonim.
Rishonim.
Yeah. Okay. It's the period before the Gaonim that's the problem. That's where we're going to get to. So I just wanted to show you. Yeah.
Say it again. The Tana and Amora are from when to when?
So the Tanaim are from somewhere early to mid second base Hamikdash. Until the beginning, middle, third century, when Rebbe concludes the Mishnah. We're
going to
talk. Right, Rebbe is Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi. That is correct. Okay, thank you for telling me. No, I appreciate it. That's good to know. My son at Or Chaim, like, which teachers will allow you to use a computer, which ones won't allow you to use a computer? Yeah. No, I know all about that.
And the Gemara then goes from the mid third.
Until the middle of the sixth.
Okay.
Yeah. Until the time of Ravina and Rav Ashi, who close the Gemara. I'm going to talk more about them, but you can see their names already in source number 3. Okay, we clear? Okay. I feel like stopping and asking everybody, who here likes history? Okay. Because if you don't, you have a problem. This is like what we're doing right now.
I'm not here today.
I want to know all about this map.
Okay, thank you.
I love
that. All right, so yeah, no, this is the part where I could really use my notes, but I'm going to do the best I can. There are Jewish communities in all of well, first of all, you recognize the Mediterranean Sea, right? That you see right there in the middle, right? That's the white body of water. It actually doesn't say Mediterranean Sea, which is funny, but...
Yeah, why don't I see it?
Is it called that thing? Whether they called it that, they probably did. A Mediterranean just means the middle of the earth, which is what they thought they were. So, yeah. I mean, if you just look, you see the Black Sea and you go south, right? You see where Israel should be, except that they don't do country boundaries. Okay.
Yeah, okay, got it. Yeah, it's not listed.
Okay. So that's the Mediterranean Sea. All right, I'll do it this way. If you look at the south shore of the Mediterranean Sea, starting in the west, okay? That is what is today called Morocco. Okay? You have a very old Jewish community in Morocco. They trace themselves, they claim to be, from when the second Beit HaMikdash still stood. But we do know that they're definitely there from right after the second Beit HaMikdash. I think it was either there or Tunisia, which we'll get to shortly, where they actually have a headstone from the 3rd century with Hebrew on it. 2nd or 3rd century with Hebrew on it. Tunisia is just east of Morocco. If you see where Carthage is, that's today Tunisia. And you had a Jewish community there as well. They become very important in the times of the Gaonim, I believe. And as you move your way east, you know, through this whole region is North Africa, right? So eventually you're going to get to Egypt. You know, you had Jewish communities there throughout the period of the second Beis HaMikdash, despite the 3 mitzvos, or 3 times that we're told don't live in Egypt. Nonetheless, we lived in Egypt. You had a massive community, for example, in Alexandria. And then as you go east and you cross the Red Sea, you get into Arab lands, Saudi Arabia, further south is Yemen. There were Jews living there as well. We know there were communities in Saudi Arabia, there were the communities in Yemen. Of course, you know, in Israel itself you have. If you go further east, you get to Iraq, and in Iraq, that was Babel. Like, that's the area. I use the word Babel loosely, because Babel technically is the city that's the capital of the empire, but it's also the Babylonian Empire, so we just call it Babel, and that's fine. But you had major yeshivos in that area. Some of the names you may recognize, Sura, Pumbedisa, right? Anyone know what Pumbedisa is today? Nope. Pumbedisa today. Good idea, though.
They are a band.
It's true.
Really?
Yeah.
That's very funny. Okay, I thought you were joking. Okay. No, Pumbedisa today. It was very funny to me because when I was learning in Israel after high school, it was the first Gulf War. And we kept hearing this city's name, and I didn't realize it was Pumbedisa. Fallujah. Wow. Fallujah in Iraq is Pumbedisa. So, Sura, Pumbedisa, Neher Da'a, another city that, if you learn Gemara, you know, but otherwise people don't hear about it, is called Masa Machsia. These were all large communities in Babel, in what is today Iraq. And that was sort of the eastern limit of major Jewish communities. Working now the north coast of the Mediterranean, you start again in the west, with the Iberian Peninsula, that's Spain and Portugal. So you had Jewish communities there already from the time when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. As you go east into Italy, obviously you had, because there were Jews who were exported to Rome, right? You find Jews in Rome in the Mishnah, right? This is always very interesting to people. You've heard the story from the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma, who was approached by somebody who wanted to pay him a lot of money to live in his town. And he said, no, any dar al b'mam kam Torah. Some of you are familiar with that, right? Mm-hmm. You know where Rabbi Yosef ben Kisma lived? This one who wouldn't live in a place that was not a place of Torah? Rome. He lived in Rome. Yeah, he lives in Rome. Like, I don't know what was so great about Rome that he wouldn't move somewhere else. Seriously, like, I think any Jew could move out of Rome. You know, that's what they would do. But I'm missing something about the way Rome was. I don't know. And then as you move further east...
Were there people there beforehand? Like, I had heard that the people of Rome redeemed a lot of the slaves that were brought
back. Oh, yeah.
They were living there even before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed.
Correct. They were living there before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Rome was a capital. Capital of this major empire. Yeah, totally. And then as you go further east, you get to an area called Anatolia, which is Greece and Turkey. And again, Jewish communities there as well. I had more in my notes to sort of give you more like the origin of the communities and how we know they existed. But I would hate the idea of misquoting something, so I'm just going to leave it as, yes, there are Jews all over there. And the reason why I'm emphasizing the fact that Jews are scattered throughout all these areas is because that creates a really big problem in the days before telecommunications. How are you going to have any knowledge of what's going on elsewhere in the Jewish world? How are you going to have resource to people who can answer questions? How are you going to have contact with other communities? And that leads to the development of the Gaonic system, where the Gaonim are the heads of yeshivos, and they are the ones who teach Torah and answer questions for Jews in all of these communities. It's a very centralized Jewish world, bless you, at that point. Everything goes through the Gaon. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the Chubos, the responses of the Gaonim, right? But they get all sorts of questions. Like, I gave you sort of the mega question, like, I need a sitter. I need to understand the history of Torah, something like that. But, like, Gaonim answer questions like, somebody came to Shul on Yom Kippur and he had a cushion to sit on. So now he was higher than everybody else. Is that okay? Like, that's a question that a Gaon is asked.
How did all these people know to revere the Gaonim who were living only in one place?
Right, and it was a very top-down structure. Not entirely smooth, meaning we'll get to, when we talk about Rav Sadia Gaon, the fact that there was a Gaon in Eretz Yisrael who thought that he should be sort of supreme Gaon and everybody should be, you know, following him. And Rav Sadia Gaon, who was not actually a Gaon when this took place, he was getting there, said, no, we don't listen to you. It's the Gaonim and Babel who matter. Like, it wasn't straightforward at all.
The calendar.
That's the calendar. Exactly. That's the calendar crisis, which illustrates exactly the problem these communities had. You had a point where Jews in different places were observing two different Yom Kippurs.
No way.
Yeah. A little bit of a mess.
Yeah. I'm not familiar. Well, during this period of the Gaonim, was it a Muslim influence or a Christian influence? Like, what was the primary religion?
Good question.
In the rest of the world?
Right. So, you know, Islam only starts in the 7th century.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't from
Right. When you see this map, actually now you can look at the arrows, this is talking about the spread of the Umayyad dynasty. There's dynasty after dynasty in the Muslim world, and we're going to have to talk about that because that's going to affect a lot of what Jews are doing during this time. But basically, at this stage, for the most part, Jews are living in Muslim-controlled lands. There were, that reminded me of one of the things that I had in my notes, there were Jews living in Andalusia. Andalusia is the area that we think of as Spain, right? So there were Jews living there. However, they migrated out when the people who were in charge there, and I'm blanking on their name now, accepted a more violent form of Christianity. And so the Jews fled, basically, from there. This was early, this was like... they fled. When I have my notes next week, I'll tell you all the things that I forgot this week.
So was there a shift in the Jewish people going from like an agrarian culture to now schools and institutions? Because you have that teacher-student relationship?
Right, so it's a good question. We were never strictly agrarian. It's not as though Jews were all farmers in the times of Tanakh or in the times of the Gemara. You always had... people in various trades. You had people who would travel place to place selling things, peddlers basically. You had smiths, and you had people who were raising animals as opposed to people who were farming. Like that existed. The three trades that you find in Sefer Bereishis, more or less, right? You have the farmer, you have the shepherd, and you have the hunter. So by the time you hit Mishnah Gemara, like Jews are doing all sorts of other things, we know that among the Tanoim, the trades that they had, right? Hillel used to carry firewood. That was his deal. Rabbi Yochanan made shoes. Rabbi Yitzchak was a blacksmith. You had different trades already then. Clearly it's more agrarian than we're used to today. That changes much later on. So you have Jews at this point who are in business, and you have Jews who are at this point owning land and farming it. My imagination tells me that those who have traveled out of Israel and are living, therefore, as minorities in another society, probably have less of a role as farmers at that point. But I'd have to do real research in order to answer that question legitimately. Yeah.
And what the scientists already?
So scientists wasn't really a thing.
What, Rambam?
Rambam is later than this.
Much later?
The Rambam isn't until the, the 12th century.
Okay. So when did Jews get to Ashkenaz?
Just to answer the question, in terms of scientists in those days are philosophers.
Right.
It's all done by thought as opposed to, empirical experimentation and that kind of thing. There is some, I shouldn't say that. There is experimentation going on. There is empirical medicine going on already earlier, meaning you find that in Greek times and you find that in the Gemara. In the Gemara, you find them, recommending certain, herbs and potions and the like based on experience. So I shouldn't say that it doesn't exist. But I don't get the impression that it's like a research thing where someone is like, running a lab.
Right.
Like, that's
and
not.
The Jews weren't.
So there were Jews in medicine. There were Jews in astronomy. But it wasn't a field.
Okay.
Like you're not teaching it and you're not, in a university and you're not, as I said, running a lab. Doing it, Shmuel is well known as a as not Shmuel the Navi, who we did last year. Shmuel, meaning Shmuel Rabin Shmuel, one of the leading sages of the third century, was well known for his medical prowess. He was a doctor. Others in that period were as well. The Gemara in Shabbos talks about the importance of learning astronomy and math in order to impress the world. They will recognize our brilliance and therefore respect the Torah.
The whole world
will be impressed.
So interesting, that's the only reason the Gemara says that you should learn those subjects?
No, but that's the Gemara in Shabbos that talks about it. That's the Gemara in Shabbos that talks about it. No. Well, the idea of impressing the world so that they will respect your Torah is really the concept. That's the idea.
As if Torah is not proof enough.
For a lot of people, it's not.
No, not proof, but impressive enough.
No, for a lot of people, it's not. That's the truth. I mean, the world had plenty of opportunities. Look, Rava at one point complains because they had these big Yarchei Kala gatherings to learn Torah twice a year, in the community. I forget if he's talking about, he's talking about Mechoza, which was another city in Bavel, which he lived in. And he says, I don't understand why all these Ami Haaretz don't see our Torah and everybody gathered in the glory of it and just all, want to come learn. Like, why doesn't that happen? Mm-hmm. And the answer is because you didn't, show that you knew math and astronomy, I guess.
Well, now we have a million doctors and however many Nobel, prize winners, and no one likes us, so clearly.
Well, liking us was never the goal.
No one respects us.
Okay. So, moving from the map, if you look at number three, I brought you there. Rebbe and Rebbe Nassan, Sof Mishnah. They conclude the Mishnah. Rebbe is really the canonizer of the Mishnah. Rebbe Nassan of sources that are contemporary to the Mishnah, the Tosafta. I'm not going to go into that right now. Rav Ashi and Ravina are Sof Hora'ah. They conclude Hora'ah. Hora'ah means not just answering halachic questions, but real psak, meaning dealing with new issues and drawing on like psukim and applying, like, to be able to address something brand new and say, this is the way we rule on this. That's Hora'ah. And that, according to this Gemara, ends when the Gemara is closed. That's it. How did that happen? Very, very unclear. We don't know what Rebbe did to conclude the Mishnah. We don't know what Ravina and Rav Ashi did to conclude the Gemara. Rav Elchanan Wasserman presented a very interesting idea, which I brought you in source number four. He's talking about how we determine certain things as Jewish practice, such that this has to be the way we do something. I'm going to read out my English translation just for time purposes. He says, the gathering of all or most of the sages of Israel anywhere is automatically the rabbinical court of all Israel. When the sages, chachamim, all or most of them get together, that is Beis Din shall call Yisrael. Regarding them, the Torah says, go to the judge who will be there at that time to deal with whatever dispute. If they get together, they can answer anything. Chasimas haMishnah haya gam kein bekibutz kochach me Yisrael o ruban asher lehena korach shabeis din agadol. He says, you want to know what happened to conclude the Mishnah? Rebbe gathered all or most of the chachamim and got them to say, okay, this is it. This is authoritative. If it's in, it's in. If it's out, it's out. That was how Mishnah came to be. It was actually a great big convocation. And va'aser l'shum adam lachlok aleihem, he prohibited anybody from disputing with them, unless bilti yemesh gam lachok in koach shabeis din agadol, unless those who disagree are going to be like that, are going to have the strength of beis din agadol. You would need that kind of convocation. The Chazon Ish writes about this, that to be clear, Rav Elchanan Wasserman was not suggesting that if today we got all the chachamim together, they could now disagree with the Mishnah. The Chazon Ish was emphatic that that's not what Rav Elchanan is actually saying here. But the argument goes that this is what they did for the Mishnah, and that this is what they did with the Gemara as well. It's not in the quote that I brought you, but I believe he also said that regarding the time of the Gemara. So that's all well and good. The problem is that having concluded the Gemara doesn't mean you've answered all questions for all time. First of all, certain things within the Gemara were not entirely clear. That's number one. Surprising, but true. So we do have teku. We do have the concept that some questions, literally, we don't know what to do with, and it's just stuck. That is true. But some things literally just weren't clear within the Gemara. There were problems. And in order to address those problems, the next generations were what were called the Savorai. Savorai is a term that Rav Shrira Gaon uses. Savorai literally means those with ideas or thoughts, like Svara, right? Or Svara, whichever one you prefer. And they're around for a very short period of time after the closing of the Gemara. Some of their words, according to Rav Shrira Gaon, make it into the Gemara. What time is it? Because I only have the time based on when we started, which I know. 11:09. Okay, so I want to make sure to give us. I'll do another 5 minutes on this, and then we'll get to do Parsha. Okay. We have to have Parsha. But Rosh Shvira Gaon, I brought you and translated for you here in source number 5, tells you what happens after the Gemara, and I'm going to read out my translation. And after that, after the closing of the Gemara, even though this certainly was not hora'a, it wasn't overstepping into what the Chachamim of the Gemara did, there were several ra'i who explained explanations and were close to hora'a. They were also groundbreakers. They were called Rabbanan Savorai. They explained anything that was uncertain, and he names some of them. Rav Chumi, Rabba and Rav Yosef, Rav Achai from Bechatim. This doesn't mean Rabba and Rav Yosef in the Gemara. These are other Rabba and Rav Yosefs. But they are mentioned in the Gemara, as he notes here. Bechatim was a city in Erda, Rav Raboi from Rov, and Rov, the city of Rav Raboi, was around the yeshivos in Erda. And the sages said, Rav Raboi from Rov was a Gaon, and he lived a long time. Fine. I'm not going into that part of it.
But the Gemara was written already.
The Gemara was written.
So they inserted themselves in there?
Read the next line. And some ideas were established in the Gemara from the later rabbis, meaning the Savoroi, like Rav Eina and Rav Simona, and we have received from the early ones, this is the tradition, Rav Shrira Gaon says, I have, in the 10th century, that the Gemara in the first chapter of Kiddushin, regarding the three methods of Kiddushin, from the beginning until Gimel Amud Beis, all of those questions and answers addressed in the Gemara, the Rabbanan Savoroi addressed them and established them. So the Gemara that we have today, the Talmud Bavli, isn't only what Ravina and Rav Ashi canonized. It also includes things that the Savoroi inserted.
Was this written down?
What do you mean?
Like, there was no printing present, so who had the copy of it? Who had, like,
the Savoroi themselves are the ones who are dealing with this. I mean,
no,
this.
She's right. If there was, like, a Gemara that was made, and then they sticking it.
Yeah, how do you know?
Everyone,
how do you know?
So they would have to promulgate whatever they were doing.
Send out, like, addendums to, like, mail it to Rome.
So it would appear, yeah.
I guess that's like Russia.
The answer is yes, as strange as that sounds. So when was what written down? The original Gemara was the middle of the 6th century. This is happening later, and yes, as they're doing it, there are things being inserted. We don't have, to the best of my knowledge, earlier editions without the Savoroi comments. There are scholars today who try to find the layers in the Gemara to identify. It's detective work, which means it's not guaranteed to be correct.
Also, like, it's surprising that we don't have so many different versions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So many, like, right. I mean, maybe many of them are lost, but...
I mean, keep in mind, you'd be talking about things that were written on paper, you know, papyrus, whatever, 1,500 years ago, which would have to survive not only the ravages of time, but also all of the different attempts by the church to get rid of everything we had.
I'm not even talking about the originals. I'm just saying, like, eventually they were copied over, right? There were people whose jobs it were to copy over these.
Yeah.
So those copies, like, how come those copies were all the same, right? Like,
maybe they inserted
something. Eventually, till the printing press, when the printing press happened, how did they say, this is the one we're printing?
Right. And the answer is that by the time you get to the printing press, which is way later, they've already... like filtered through and said, these are the ones that we're using.
Yeah,
this is what we're keeping.
Right, so that's the interesting part.
So,
what did they do in the 5th century?
What do you mean? They didn't have a written Gemara.
So
it was all verbal.
All of these.
Yeah. Mishnah was written at that point already, and Gemara was verbal.
How smart these guys were! Like, how did they know?
Yeah, no, I mean, there were what's called Megillas Starim. That was written like scrolls that people just kept in the days of the Gemara with halachos on them. The Gemara refers to it, but it was something that wasn't to be published. It was just like, I got my scroll with certain things. They would write down brachos for davening. Others were against doing that. Yeah. But if you take a look in the part that I translated here in source number 5 about the years, where it starts with 107, you see that? So he notes the Savoroi lived a very short period of time. This was not a long thing. The years that he gives, and this is what I meant when I said to Chayala before that we're going to be dealing with a third calendar, his years that Rav Shvira Gaon uses are the Seleucid years. From when the Seleucids, Greeks, right, from the Greek, they were Greek Empire, when they took over the area where Israel was. This is what we call Minyan Shtaros. It was the dating that we used on legal documents, and apparently it's still in use in his day. So I gave you in parentheses what it is in the secular calendar today. So he's talking about people who were leaders for a year, 2 years, 3 years in the early 6th century, overlapping with the closing of the Gemara, as you can see.
Why did their years start?
They start because that was the system that Seleucids had in their empire. That's what you used on legal documents.
How do you spell Seleucid?
S-E-L-E-U-C-I-D. They were one of the three empires that came about, three or four, after Alexander the Great died and his empire was split up. So you had the Ptolemies, you had the Seleucids. There's another one, but I'm blanking right now on the name. Sorry.
So the point of this is to say that the Savarai was a very short period of time.
Yes, correct. Mm-hmm. Okay. So should we do some parsha?
Sure.
Is that a good idea? Okay.